His thesis reads, "This thesis can be summed up in a single, deeply held conviction that in science and philosophy alike, an exclusive preoccupation with logical systematicity has been destructive of both historical understanding and rational criticism. Men demonstrate their rationality not by ordering their concepts and beliefs into tidy formal structures, but by their preparedness to respond to novel situations with open minds. The test of rationality is not how many plans you carry around with you and hope to use at the right moment, but do you have a live sense of planner in you that is open to the unknown? Then you are rational. That's what is rational." Notice that's exactly the way the I Ching looks at rationality. It is complementary to the way in which the Bhagavad Gita looks at rationality, but quite different. So that men demonstrate their rationality not by ordering their concepts and beliefs into tidy formal structures, but by their preparedness to respond to new situations with open minds, acknowledging the shortcomings of their former procedures and moving beyond them. This is the essence of what we would call an empirical outlook and a pragmatic technique. The combination of the two was first given its character in philosophic and psychological language by William James. Towards the end of his life, William James, at a very high point of human brilliance, and I mean a high point of human brilliance, William James, towards the end of his life, was on a level of Nagarjuna. He called it radical empiricism. And he has a whole volume of essays that came from a series of lectures, essays on radical empiricism. He did it about 7 or 8 years after he did the Varieties of Religious Experience. Just superb. And the last book of essays that ever came out from him that followed essays on radical empiricism were the essays that were collected under the title A Pluralistic Universe. What is the new ideal in 20th century scientific spiritual outlook? That this is a pluralistic universe. It has room for all kinds of human beings. Kinds that you never even dreamed are welcome. That Mother Nature likes a big family is just the basic truth of it. She likes to see something new. So he writes, "Here again, the key notions are adaptation and demand." Demand not in an economic sense, but demand in this kind of a pragmatic sense. What's going to happen? What can happen? Like my friend, the late Theodore Sturgeon said, out of the 10,000 things that can happen, only one is really going to happen. And the intelligent thing is to face up to what is actually happening. Don't get delayed and don't get watered down and mooning about and moaning about what could happen. What is happening is the only fruitful movement that is occurring. And to be able to discern that, that is propitious. So Stolman writes, "Here again, the key notions are adaptation and demand rather than form and validity. So a logic which is concerned with form and validity and systematizing thereby is quite inferior. In fact, breeds illusion all the time, rather than a rationality which has a logic based on adaptation and demand. It's different. Life moves by adaptation and demand, not by the validity and form of some logical system. I have to say something here that's a little astounding, but for instance, Mr. Hall always talks about the universal plan. Everything has to move according to a universal plan. That's the logical systematicity of form and validity. If there is any plan at all in life, it's that there is no plan. That's the plan. Whatever can, in fact, happen will continue as long as it can continue. So that by following the ecology of the real, one sometimes has to silence the mind and silence its worldly pet peeve that it has categorized all the possibilities and has them down on some little computer somewhere. It's like the lesson that a young would-be pool hustler has to learn. You can know all there is to know about the shots and the table and the balls and everything, but that's not going to help you if you're not able to just set that aside and just do it. And the best hustler in a pool situation is the one that can, for the longest time, not think about it, just do it. And as long as you're running the tables, don't worry about whether you got it right or not. You see? Because as soon as you think about your opponent's cigarette ash burning into the table, you're going to miss the next shot. It's a kind of a Southside Chicago Zen. Notice here, and here Tolman brings it in. Plato's program for philosophy took it for granted that the functional adequacy of geometrical forms was self-guaranteeing, so that there must, in the last resort, be only one idea of the good, and that a mathematical one. The philosophical agenda proposed here sets aside all such assumptions in favor of patterns of analysis which are at once more historical, more empirical, and more pragmatic. Now, this is unfortunate here, and the whole reason I'm doing the Plato series at PRS is to redress some of the misunderstanding about Plato. You cannot reduce Plato down to this standpoint. Tolman himself studied under Ludwig Wittgenstein, and from Wittgenstein's standpoint, Plato is certainly a dead end, the beginning of a dead end. But Plato himself was never the beginning that manifested itself as Wittgenstein. Plato was in fact a Pythagorean, and there are mysteries in Plato, and I'll have plenty of chance to work on that. But Tolman makes the point. The formal validity of the logical system of the mind falls short of its own ideals all the time. not because it isn't good at doing this, but precisely because it is good at doing this. The mind can hold itself to the yoga of logical form all the way to the end. The mind doesn't have any problem of hanging on to the criteria of logical form and can hold on to it all the way to silence. You can get that far. Or, to put it in its polar opposite, you can have a system designer design a computer program that is so refined that the bug list grows to asymptotic lengths. It's the same way. You get reduced to silence, not because you can't go any further, but because you can take it all the way. Remember the preface to Carver Mead's book on analog VLSI and neural systems, very large systems integration. And he gave us the quotation in here from Marvin Minsky in 1977, who opened a seminar at Caltech with the following observation. Our first foray into artificial intelligence was a program that did a credible job of solving problems in college calculus. Armed with that success, we tackled high school algebra. We found to our surprise that it was much harder. Attempts at grade school arithmetic involving the concept of numbers provided problems of current research and interest. In other words, we're still trying to figure out what's going on there. And an exploration of the child's world of blocks proves insurmountable, except under the most rigidly constrained circumstances. It finally dawned on us that the overwhelming majority of what we call intelligence is developed by the end of the first year of life. In other words, when you work back, when the mind in its pulse form mode of psychic energy goes forward, thought works better and better and better. But when it goes back, it becomes more and more difficult because its origin is not in nature but in the deep self. It's the deep self that thinks. Nature doesn't think. Nature is real. The mind thinks. But the mind is only a delimiting function. It may be infinite, but it's like one quarter and no more. At its most, it's an infinite pi wedge going out. And as it recedes, as it pulls its projective willfulness back in, more and more it finds that not only does it not work, but it doesn't exist. And you can, in very sophisticated meditation, pull the mind all the way back to its vanishing. And if you can stand the fear and the terror of erasing your own mental functioning capacity, and you get surprised that you're still there, I don't know what the Sanskrit term for it is. In English, we say shit. It's a peculiar, it's a very peculiar kind of a psychological, that the mind can function or not function, that it's like an instrument that you can turn on and use or you can turn off and not use, but that you do not vanish when you turn off the mind. In fact, it doesn't seem to impair you at all. It just means that you can't talk about it. Or as the Buddha found out, who would you tell? You know, when he came out of, I guess you know that he didn't just sit under one tree. Do you know that? He sat under four trees. Four trees. And the Bodhi tree is the fourth of the trees. And when he came to enlightenment, there were two traveling merchants that came by. And in his enlightened sentience, he realized that there was no way whatsoever to tell these two travelers that they were enlightened. There was no possibility whatsoever. But he still did it. He still gave the teachings, because what occurred there was, in that realization, that they're already enlightened, and all they have to do, you don't have to tell them like telling them something new, just get them to recognize in their own selves. So there's a hierophantic teaching quality which can be given, and that's the basis of compassion. You're not giving perfection to somebody, you're helping them to realize themselves. So that the higher teaching is always has that compassion. You're not giving them anything they don't already have. What did the bag man say? Muktananda. I call him the bag man of yogis. He said, you can't give away what you haven't got. See? It's like that. What the I Ching is concerned with, and what 20th century science is concerned with, is giving away the deep self's energy totally by differentiating to the nth degree. You can't say that too hard these days. Whereas before, the whole direction was to realize within. Now the paradigm has shifted to realize without. And it's like the Earth changing magnetic poles. The Earth is not going to be destroyed because the magnetic poles reverse. In fact, we know now that the magnetic poles reverse all the time. At certain junctures, they completely reverse. An enantiodromia of unimaginable consequences. But that it is a part of the hidden, larger ecology of the real for magnetic poles to reverse. The same way in terms of the archetypal structure of the psyche in the real, its mode processes reverse from time to time. We had a whole age where integration was the number one priority. Now we have an age where differentiation is the number one priority. And there were past ages where differentiation was also the priority. Happy days are back again. The Democrats are back in power. Now we're going to differentiate. Whereas the Republican integrators were in for a long time, now they're out. Doesn't mean they're gone. They'll be back. Sure as shooting, they'll be back in a couple thousand years. It'll be just fine. But now what is really happening is that the archetype of the deep self is in a radiant mood. It's a time to give it to you, Christian apocalyptists. It's the age of the Holy Spirit. To go out, outward bound. Let's go out. It's a time for Maitreya Buddha, who doesn't sit in meditation, but whatever he does is the meditation. If he's fixing the flat on the tire, that's the meditation. It's the changing of the magnetic poles. So that Tolman says, as so often, this is on page 52 of Human Understanding, as so often happens with polar extremes, we shall find that for all their surface incompatibility, the two positions are united by one common presupposition. The two polarities are united by a common context. What are the two poles? The two poles are integration or differentiation. What are they united by? By the real. But at any one time, when you're living, when you're in life movement, the best that you can do is to manifest half of what there is. The other half just doesn't manifest. It's there, but it just doesn't manifest. Because it has to be background for the half that can manifest. That's all. It's as simple as that. It's as unfrightening as that. Tolman says this of the mind. As so often happens with polar extremes, we shall find that for all their surface incompatibility, the two positions are united by one common presupposition. But both still accept the familiar assumption that rationality must be equated with logicality, and that different concepts and beliefs can be compared rationally only so long as they can both be referred to a single logical system. And that this is a limitation that needs to be overcome in terms of thought. And the limitation that needs to be overcome for us is all the false bad teachers that in the last 30 or 40 years have stressed the misstatement rather than the actuality. It's like a whole gaggle of two-bit gurus who've stressed the mind's realization, but the mind's realization is not it. That's not it. And especially what usually gets left out when you stress the mind's realization is the feeling comprehension. And usually the deputy that gets promoted along with the mind is insight. And the body suffers. But generally what happens is that kind of disinterested, neutral lack of heart that characterizes the quick and clever. And so we have an age of up-and-coming super con men, all in the name of enlightenment. And Mother Nature's just not going to accept it. She likes it, one or two characters like this, but to have a whole population is a bit much. And she's not going to feed them all. Let's come back here to Tolman. Here is a new definition of rationality without bringing in logicality. Notice that one can be completely rational and not even have to talk about logicality. Don't even have to mention it. He writes, "The absolutist asserts that on a sufficiently abstract quasi-mathematical level, such standards can still be formulated as eternal principles," quote-unquote. while the relativist simply denies that any such standpoint can have any universal validity. And this same common assumption prevents both men from coming to terms with the rationality of conceptual change. You can highlight in your hearing change. The I Ching is the book of changes. The absolutist and the relativist, in that polarity, between the two of them, there's no choice for rationality. Both are caught up in illusion. Both of them. It's like Camus once said that we seem to have this idea of pleasure and pain as being the polarities on the continuum, but pleasure and pain are both together on one end of a spectrum that the other end is that there is no feeling whatsoever. So to get lost in struggling to try to get more pleasure and away from the pain forever freezes you out in left field from life. Because the issue in life is not to grab more pleasure and flee from more pain, but to balance pleasure and pain with the very lack of feeling. Balance that out. So Tolman writes, how then are we to avoid the difficulties of both these reactions? And they are in fact reactions. They're not actions which present persons, but they're reactions which represent positions which persons then have to fill. You have to fit into the little pigeonholes which the logical system throws out. And because you do, you expect everyone else to, and if they're not fitting into your cubbyholes, your little pigeonholes, well, goddamn them. Or yourself, if you're not able to do that, you see. How are we to avoid the difficulties of both these reactions? The first step is to reject the commitment to logical systematicity. This does not mean an anti-intellectual pogrom. That's not it. It's not what's being said at all. The first step is to reject the commitment to logical systematicity, which makes absolutism and relativism appear the only alternatives available. This decision, the rejection of the commitment to that horns of a dilemma, this decision brings us to the heart of the matter, for it was, in fact, always a mistake to identify rationality and logicality. It was always a mistake to identify rationality with logicality. He writes with the English use of the preposition here rather than the American. The American is better here. To suppose, that is, that the rational ambitions of any historically developing intellectual activity can be understood entirely in terms of the propositional or conceptual systems in which its intellectual content may be expressed at one time or another time. Questions of rationality are concerned precisely not with the particular intellectual doctrines that a man or a professional group adopts at any given time, but rather with the conditions on which and the manner in which he is prepared to criticize and change those doctrines as time goes on. The rationality of a science. Now we're getting to it. The rationality of a science or of science itself as a whole, for instance, is embodied not in the theoretical systems current in it at particular times, but in its procedures for discovery and conceptual change through time. Formal logic, as Quine and Collingwood agree, William Willard Van Orman Quine was a great Harvard logician, may still be alive, little gray mustache and a beret and sharp eyes, and Collingwood, R.G. Collingwood, Oxford Don of the 30s and 40s, very intelligent man. Formal logic, as Quine and Collingwood agree, is concerned simply with the inner articulation of intellectual systems whose basic concepts are not currently in doubt. Such logical relations can be considered either at some particular time or apart from time. In this sense, there is, of course, no logic in the discovery of new concepts. But that in no way entails that conceptual changes in science do not take place in a rational manner. It entails only that the rationality of scientific discovery, of the intellectual procedures by which scientists agree on well-founded conceptual changes, necessarily eludes analysis and judgment in logical terms alone. In other words, one of the most well-known and profound of all psychological observations is that the creative process cannot be logically declined. You can't say what it is. Yet the creative process itself is very well understood, and there's any amount of testimony to it, but it's on the level of testimony rather than on the level of evidence. Because your creative process is your creative process, and you can tell us how you do it, but there's no way that we can analytically dissect that and reproduce it again in someone else. It's a well-known situation. So that here Tolman flexes his muscles. From this point on, accordingly, we must set aside the traditional cult of systematicity. And that's putting it exactly where it is. It was just a cult. You know, it's just like in, remember the movie Gunga Din about the cult of the Kali stranglers? The people insisting that you be logical were members of a life-strangling cult, working under the aegis that we represent a truthful functioning of the mind, and are you against thought? The hell you say. I don't go public because I get fighting mad at this point. I feel like clearing out the bar at this point. This is where I come in. My generation was led astray by this kind of junk to the exclusion of very, very few. Tolman. From this point on, accordingly, we must set aside the traditional cult of systematicity and carry our analysis of concepts. See, we can still have analysis without the cult of systematicity. Isn't that amazing? The I Ching says we've been doing it for 3,000 years. In science and elsewhere, the great travesty, of course, is that the cult of systematicity has sought to put blinders on science. You can't find out about that. We don't want you to find out about that. You find out about this. That has been extended most precariously to education and religion. So that by 1990, we live in a very subtle totalitarian world, as far as education, learning, and as far as religion, believing, are concerned. The whole planet is constrained. Terrible. I mean, there's so much work for a bodhisattva, it's amazing. From this point on, accordingly, we must set aside the traditional cult of systematicity and carry our analysis of concepts in science and elsewhere back to its proper starting point. Where is the proper starting point? The deep self. Where does the analysis begin? In the deep self. So that somebody who can't come to themselves is at a disadvantage right away because they're never going to be able to think, feel, have insight, be sensate in any kind of truthful or joyous way. Because they're going to be queued up behind these demagogic Pied Pipers who tell them what to think, tell them what to feel, tell them what insights you can have. You better sit on your meditation cushion, young Westerner. Brother. Tolman. The intellectual content of any rational activity forms neither a single logical system nor a temporal sequence of such systems. There is no system, and there is no pastiche of super systems of systems. Now, a lot of things that you'll see in the continuing guerrilla warfare with constrainment, false constrainment in the 1990s, will be meta-system builders. Oh, that's right, there are no systems, but there are meta-systems of systems, and we've got the master plan. Well, there's no plan, but there is a master plan of plans. Watch out. Beware of that one. That one's in the wind. Tolman, writing this 17 or 18 years ago. The intellectual content of any rational activity, notice that rational is an activity. Even the term thought function, thought is not a thing, it's a functioning. So that what is real to it is not that it is, but that it's happening. It's a whole difference. No one can cudgel you with an idea. If you experience psychologically a cudgeling from an idea, you've set yourself up as a target, and that's a whole delusion. An idea is a functioning that's happening, and you can participate in it to some extent or not. But to be hit by it means that you've set yourself up as a target, as in deluding yourself. Right away, you can tell. If you feel bombarded by an idea because it's too new or too much, that's an indication that you're running a fever. That you're already sick. Because that condition doesn't really arise. Notice here, our science is coming to its culmination in realizing that the whole logical formulation of science as a system is an illusion. But the only way in which that illusion can be dispersed is not to continue with that process of engendering the illusion, but to withdraw the willfulness, the arrogant horns, from keeping on with it and coming back to your symbolic deep self. And when you do, whatever can vanish will. And whatever naturally does occur will reoccur again. It's like the big sleep. Because by bringing those arrogant horns back in, all the false structures that were supported by this, that were leeching off your giving of this formal possibility, they vanish. They not they seemingly collapse in the social world, but they vanish psychologically. It's like somebody in Czechoslovakia today, whereas a month ago they would still be laboring under the communist system, 1 month later, somebody in Czechoslovakia is no longer laboring under the communist system, but is genuinely concerned with human values. What are we going to do to eat today, is the question. Not, is the party right about these quotas? You see, it's irrelevant. The fact is, we're hungry today. All of us are hungry today. Let's do something about it. Do you notice how empirical, how pragmatic, how historical, how humane that is? All that was forbidden, blindfolded, by the continuing commitment to, in this case, this example, the communist system. You can see how quickly psychologically it vanishes. And if there's a truly mobile society, the collapse doesn't last very long sociologically either. The sting has gone in a couple of days because it's replaced by something real. People with seeds and holes and shovels going out planting food. We're hungry? What are we going to... Let's plant some seeds. Let's find some source of food in the meantime, but let's start our food supply going by actually putting the seeds in the ground. One of my old teachers used to say, you can't get the cake baked until you put the ingredients together, put it in the oven. But you have to understand the whole ecology, that you have to do all of these things in order to get that cake. You can't just put all the ingredients together and say, God, I put all those ingredients together. Did you put it in the oven? Is the oven on? You see, it all has to work. There's a wholesomeness to the round of activity. That's the core of the pragmatic outlook. What's the fulsomeness of this activity? Make sure that the fulsomeness is there. It's not only that you have to change the baby, but you got to put a new diaper on, and then you got to put some more food in. That's the whole ecology. If you just take the old diaper off and you put the new diaper on and you don't feed the baby, that's self-defeating. And the baby rightfully will say, ah, you idiot. You got to feed me too. That's a part of the ecology of this whole situation. The same thing with the human personality. The human personality is a full ecology that needs all of the elements, including freedom, to be operating actually to be itself. And there are many kinds of personalities. Many. But all of them need to have this full ecology. One of the elements is freedom. Tolman. The intellectual content of any rational activity forms neither a single logical system nor a temporal sequence of such systems. No meta-systems. Oh, one of the worst meta-historical theories ever was National Socialism, the Nazis. It was a meta-history. And in fact, there's a whole beautiful book done by Peter Weyrich in the 1950s about the Nazi meta-history. One has to be very, very cautious about these kinds of things. Rather, writes Tolman, it is an intellectual enterprise whose rationality lies in the procedures governing its historical development and evolution. He italicizes intellectual enterprise. It's an intellectual enterprise whose rationality lies in the procedures governing its historical development and evolution. Notice that without the historical consciousness, this can't occur. It doesn't register. It doesn't have any place to register. History precedes science. It's the indispensable criterion. If you don't have history, if you're not able to engender historical consciousness, you don't get science, but that activity leads to a pseudoscience. What is the pseudoscience? It's the regression back from the person operating in the world, which generates history, and the regression from that, instead of having science as pseudoscience, means that the person regresses back into a kind of a phony magic. Not the generative hermetic magic that allows for the person to become real, but that kind of phony magic which is pseudoscience. And because the only way that in which no deep self is operating in a pseudoscience, a kind of a false magic, because there's no deep self, the next level comes into play. And what's the next level? The next level is the level of the mask. So what comes into play in pseudoscience is the mask, the role. And whatever was the strongest egotistical role before in that person's life cycle, that's what will come into play. Not necessarily the role that they were playing at the moment when that happened, but the strongest fragmented role, the strongest mask in their makeup will come into play, and they'll become in this pseudo-scientific, phony, magical way, their pet image of themselves. That's the ego, in the derisive sense. That's the ego. Not the ego in the basic structure of the universe, but the ego of my favorite mask. And because it's a regressive energy, because one is no longer differentiating, but one is falling into a kind of a false integration. Regression is a false integration. It has all the properties of integration, but it's not real integration. It's a disintegration of differentiation. It only seems like integration. It's actually a disintegration of differentiation. To be specific about it, the term that philosophically is used for that procedure, although used with pride instead of being shocked that it's happening, is the philosophic term deconstruction. One deconstructs. And then one is very good at deconstructing, one's really happy to tear it all down. And especially to deconstruct other people. Well, I mean, that's what's really good for them, is to be deconstructed. The very essence of punk, right? Nothing should work the way it's been working. So, Tolman, finishing up here, and this is the end. For limited certain purposes, we may find it useful to represent the provisional outcome of such an enterprise in the form of a propositional system, as in a logic, but this will remain an abstraction, a tool. The system so arrived at is not the primary reality. It's like the notion of a geometrical point. It will be a fiction or an artifact of our own making, and we will know that and remember that. It's only a tool that we are now picking up to use, and we can put the tool down when we're finished. Notice the craft of being human. You can use any tool that you want, any tool that you need. You can even make tools. But know when it's time propitiously to put that tool down. See? In all our subsequent inquiries, therefore, our starting point will be the living, historically developing intellectual enterprises within which concepts find their collective use. And our results must be referred back for validation to our experience in those historical enterprises. Now, these living, historically developing intellectual enterprises is a long, convoluted phrase for human beings. Now, I compared, in the Thursday lecture, I compared Tolman's book to Heidegger's book from 1926, Sein und Zeit, Being and Time, in that both were unfinishable. This was to be the first of three volumes. And the second volume was to be entitled The Individual Grasp and Development of Concepts. And he couldn't do it. Why? Because he started out with a static diagram of what he wanted to do, just like Heidegger in Sein und Zeit. He gave a masterful philosophic description on an abstract level of Dasein, of being there, human being in its ultimate abstracted form. But when it came time to write the next sections of Sein und Zeit, putting that diagram in motion, the motion disintegrated the coherency of the diagram. It's like a photograph that's a beautiful photograph, and when you move it, it catches fire and burns up. It's just like that. And Tolman did the very same thing. It's a mistake that someone who doesn't practice makes. It's a wonderful snapshot. Very, very useful, but it is only a photograph. A true representation of what he is talking about would not be a book on human understanding, but would be an educational process that actually works. Not a book about it, but a process that actually does generate human understanding. So what would a true book on human understanding be? It'd be an educational program. So hopefully, where geniuses like Heidegger and Tolman have failed, Br'er Rabbits like me will be a little more successful, because we've not depended on brilliant minds so much, but because we've been delinquent all our lives and have tried to figure out how it really happens so that we could live with it. One great virtue of being a Br'er Rabbit is that you want to keep moving on down the trail, and you don't want to just have the pride of accomplishing the answer, but you want to get back to the briar patch. It's a life-saving grace to not to want to have the solution, but to want to be free and live, and just getting the solution out of the way so that you can go back and live. I guess we should stop there. The hexagram thrown today was following, number 17, with moving lines in the first, second, and sixth. So if you're looking for the hexagram, you'll have following as the hexagram. And in the following, number 17 will be in the third place. In the second place will be the hexagram before it, which is 16, which is enthusiasm, and the hexagram in the third place following it will be number 18, which is decay, work on what has been spoiled. So the sequence runs enthusiasm, following, decay, and the moving lines change and become a hexagram 6, so that in the fifth place, in our five-point cycle, you'll have hexagram number 6, which is conflict. And then the obverse of this would be in the first hexagram would be soon
soon over Ken, which is 53. So the first hexagram would be 53, which is a development, gradual progress. So the sequence would run development, enthusiasm, following, decay, conflict. So that the five-phase energy cycle for this runs in that kind of a sequence. It's not a bitter pill, don't worry. It just characterizes the situation. Next week, bring your Bhagavad Gitas, and please read up to the 36th sloka in chapter 6.